Well, hello, everybody. Welcome once again to the Tech Doctor podcast. It's a pleasure to have you back with us today because this is going to be an exciting one. I promise you fun and excitement, and you will hear some things that you have not heard before on the Tech Doctor podcast. I'm thrilled to have with me one of the premier Apple podcasters. She's been doing it a long time and does it very, very well. It's Allison Sheridan with the NosillaCast. And Allison, welcome to the Tech Doctor podcast.
Oh, I'm just thrilled to be on. I'm an avid listener to the Tech Doctor and love talking to you and gotten a lot of help from you over the years. And I'm excited to be here.
Well, likewise, I've gotten help from you as well. I remember when we started this podcast, you helped me get my logo straightened out on iTunes. And that was a big help because for us blind guys, logos aren't so easy to figure out sometimes.
Not quite the top priority either, I would suspect.
No, not quite the top priority. But you do a podcast on Sunday evenings called the NosillaCast, and I've been listening to it for years and years. In fact, I sort of have this routine where I have to listen to the NosillaCast every Monday during my lunch hour at work. And if they make me go to a meeting or something, I get really cranky until I get my NosillaCast fixed in sometimes that day. So there may be Tech Doctor listeners, one or two, who don't know about the NosillaCast. Please tell us a bit about what it is, why you do it, and just anything you want to say about it.
Oh, you know, I hate talking about myself and my show, Robert.
I know you do, but bear up. Bear up as best you can.
I will try. Okay. So the NosillaCast is, my tagline is a technology geek podcast with an ever so slight Macintosh bias. In other words, a giant Macintosh bias. And but I'm also interested in, gadgets and freeware, shareware, open source tools, pretty much anything geeky. I've had Windows Phone 7 people on the show. I've had Android people on the show. I'm just interested. I just love it all. We've talked about Linux, had a couple of different Linux people on, had a lot of fun with it. I started the show because I found that I was torturing everyone near me with conversations about technology. I was, stopping strangers in the grocery store to show them a new gadget I got or something like that. And I got the idea when podcasting first started, maybe I ought to just talk to people who want to listen, who would actually choose to listen to me yap about this stuff.
Yeah, find people who care, right?
Exactly. Okay. I still annoy people in the grocery store, but
sure, why not?
Unavoidable.
Otherwise, the grocery store would be so boring. Anyway, go ahead.
Exactly. But I also, I started it in 2005, in I think it was May 13th, 2005. So I've been at it 6.5 years, and it's pretty much like clockwork. And I find that there are a lot of people like you, Robert, who are, they've got to get their NosillaCast fix on Mondays, because it's so regular. Maybe I get the more anal retentive audience than most people because I'm not loosey-goosey with when it comes out.
Yes, the show is very organized and on time and very moves at a nice pace. It's really well done. And so, that's the reason I think we keep listening. It's something new and fun and entertaining, and we learn something every week. So my hat's off to you for the way you go about that show.
Well, thank you. Yeah, you never know what you're going to get, too.
No, and that's one of the great things about it, I think. You've evolved over the years with Dumb Question Corner and Chit Chat Across the Pond and all those features that we all look forward to, but they're all, each week it's a little bit different. And so I encourage anyone who hasn't checked it out to try out the NosillaCast. And I believe also, I've not participated in this before, but you have some sort of live chat that people can participate in.
Yeah, on Sunday nights, my website, by the way, is podfeet.com, podfeet.com. And at podfeet.com/live on Sunday nights at 5 p.m. Pacific time, I do the show live where you can watch me if you're a sightling and participate in a live chat room and actually hear me creating the show. So I'll stop talking to the audience. I'll start recording. I'll hit stop, and then everybody yells at me to save because of a terrible incident one year where everything went horribly wrong, and I had not saved, and we had to start over.
Ooh, yeah.
That was a bad day.
Yeah.
But now it's a tradition to yell save at me. Really, really fun audience, really tight group of people who I'm not sure it's even necessary that I'm there anymore. One week I was on travel, so I did the show early. I do it early, not late, and I did the show early, and so they wanted to get together, so they went to someone else's show and just talked to each other in that channel.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't go quite so far. I think you're kind of the driving force behind the NosillaCast. So
perhaps
probably it's a good idea. probably a good idea for you to be there. But nonetheless, I understand what you're saying. And so people might want to check out the live.
Yeah, show. Now that show is hosted on Justin.tv, which is in Flash, which I know is problematic. So I also broadcast it over IceCast, which gives me a non-Flash version that you can get to right from podfeet.com/live. So you can just click it there. It's accessible on the iPhone, the iPad too. So you can, and I assume Android and the others.
Excellent, excellent. Well, I didn't realize that. I'll have to check that out sometime once I get done with my basketball obsession that's going on right now. I may check that out on Sunday afternoons here for us. And really, you've given me a very nice segue into something that we want to talk about primarily on this version of the Tech Doctor podcast. You just mentioned that you were providing an alternative, non-Flash-based, accessible way to access your live show. And accessibility for people who are blind is something that I know you've been interested in and advocating for a long time, even though your podcast isn't really an accessibility podcast. It's a mainstream Apple podcast with that ever so slight bias. But tell us a little bit about how in the world did you get interested in blind people and how they access computers and technology?
Well, it actually started when I was around 8 years old when I read a book called Follow My Leader by James Garfield. It was a story of a little boy who, with his friends, played with a firecracker and he was blinded by it. Oh. And it takes him through his, you know, denial and you know, being horrified that he was blind and how he learns to adjust to the world as the way it is for him now. And in the book, they showed a picture of what the Braille alphabet looks like. And this is where I know it's just in my DNA to want to understand things is I got a piece of cardboard as a little 8-year-old girl and I punched little dots so that I could learn the Braille alphabet on my own.
How cool is that?
Yeah, it just was fascinating to me that there was a language I didn't know that I could learn from this, you know, from this alphabet. And I got to where I could recognize the letters. I didn't get much further than that. But I think that was my first genesis of being intrigued with a separate language for the blind. Over the years, I'm not exactly sure where it kicked in. My mother is legally blind. I have a couple of aunts who are blind. But I'm not sure that was the biggest influence as just meeting blind people. I think Daryl Shandro of the Blind Access Journal was my first blind friend.
Okay.
Where he just started telling me about things that I didn't know about. And it was so fascinating what could go on. And he was a Windows user at the time. I believe he has switched, or at least he's a slider now.
Well, he certainly got him an iPhone. He's posting all these audio booths with the iPhone and so forth. So I don't know whether he's using a Mac or not. But he's moving in the right direction.
Right, right. The following year at the Podcast Expo, I met Slough, who's owns his own music studio in New York, and he's completely blind. And he was interesting, and he had all these things he could tell me. And I was just amazed that, well, wait a minute, you can run a music studio blind? And we've had some really fun conversations. Like, I find it amazing that he can edit audio without being able to see.
Right. We do that. You know, we edit these podcasts that way. But Slough is a great guy, but I'll tell you a horrifying but lovely story. I asked Slough to talk to my 17-year-old son a couple years ago while he was thinking about college, because my son really, really at the time thought he wanted to be a recording engineer and work in a recording studio. And so I spent this time arranging this great conversation between my son and Slough so they could discuss the recording industry. And the first thing Slough said to my son was, "Forget college. Go to a recording studio, get you a job as a janitor if you have to, and work your way up."
Oh,
and,
no.
And so it's turned out that, you know, my son has moved on and really is now planning on majoring in film at the University of Texas. But nonetheless, it was one of those conversations that a parent sitting there like, I suspect he's probably right, but this is not exactly the road we wanted to go down here. So I love that. You know, I love that. And so Graham and I had a good talk about that when they got off the phone. But you've met quite a few of us or talked to us, interacted with those of us who are blind over the years. And it sounds like that has just really whetted that interest or continued your interest in that area.
What I like to tell people was it opened my eyes.
Yeah, good point. Good point. Well, you know, one thing that I really appreciate about you, Allison, and admire a lot is that you don't just talk that talk, but you walk the walk when it comes to accessibility advocacy. And this year, just a couple of weeks ago, you certainly stepped out on the wild side at the Macworld iWorld annual conference, which is a big conference for Apple fans, where they have a show floor where people can see various products and talk to vendors. But they also have a lot of place for people to do presentations. And I know that you did a very interesting presentation this year at Macworld iWorld that I think will be fascinating for our Tech Doctor listeners to hear about. So if you don't mind, tell us what you did and, well, how you did it.
Well, I've wanted to learn voiceover, so I've had a lot of conversations with people like Daryl and Slough and you and a bunch of other people about accessibility, and Scott Howell is another big advocate that's a lot of fun to talk to, and he would frequently ask me, well, that tool that you just described, is it accessible? And I didn't know how to figure out if it was accessible. So every time he'd ask me, I said, I don't know, try it, you know, because I didn't know how to test it. I mean, I could turn on VoiceOver and look at it and see what it did, but I didn't know how to navigate to figure out whether it was actually working. So I thought, well, I really kind of want to learn how to do VoiceOver and really get into it and understand what it does and how it works. I figured the only way I could make myself do that was if I volunteered to do a paper at Macworld blindfolded.
Oh, okay.
So I put in a thing saying that I wanted to come demonstrate. If you read my original submission, what it says is that I was going to use a Mac blindfolded, and I was going to install software, and I was going to write emails, and I had quite grandiose plans of what I could learn to do.
And why not just rebuild the machine and put in a flash drive and do a few other things while you're at it, right?
Yeah, exactly. Okay. So what ended up happening was it became somewhat limited from that, but I did add in that I ended up using an iPhone and then switching to a Mac. And so my plot of what I ended up doing, and actually this was my son's idea, which I thought was pretty cool. Kyle suggested that I have a plot, that not just do things, but have some sort of theme to what I was doing. So I took on my iPhone, I turned on a VoiceOver, and I wrote a text message to Katie Floyd of the Mac Power Users and asked her out to dinner that night or the following night.
Okay, hold it. You did this all blindfolded. You got up and got in front of this audience, I assume, and put some sort of blindfold on.
Yes.
Okay. Now, what was that like standing there at that moment before you, say, took out this iPhone and maybe started up VoiceOver? What was it like to stand there in front of that audience blindfolded?
Pretty terrifying. I didn't sleep well the night before, if that gives you any indication. And I think actually it was worse a couple of weeks before. A couple of weeks before some of my testing, I was simply stuck. I could not figure out how to do some things, and I didn't know what I was going to do because I was not going to be successful if I couldn't get over these humps. But with the help of my blind friends, I was able to get over those humps and actually make progress. So I think I was a little more terrified a couple of weeks before than I was actually on stage.
Well, so one thing you had done, obviously, is practiced a lot.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. My final slide is thanking Katie Floyd for the hundreds of text messages she received over the weeks inviting her to dinner.
Okay. Okay. Well, you're going to have to buy a lot of dinners there. Okay. So really, one of the things that you obviously discovered was that if you are, and of course, it's not a real fair comparison because it's not the same if you're a person who's been blind for your whole life as it is for a sighted woman wearing a blindfold only temporarily. But nonetheless, we're going to go with this for a minute. One of the things that you clearly learned about, obviously, is that to do a presentation blind with VoiceOver takes an awful lot of preparation and practice and an awful lot of thought into how you'll actually go about it. And I guess I'm really curious to know, how does that level of preparation and thought compare to other presentations that you do not under the blindfold?
I'm glad you asked that question because I'm a very, very experienced speaker. I used to run an organization of about 150 people, and I would stand up in front of that crowd twice a month and present to them. And it was just nothing to me. Nothing to me to present to vice presidents. I've done Blog World Expo a number of times. I've done user groups, and the level of preparation I do is frighteningly close to zero. because what I always pick as my topics is something I already know how to do. So doing a preparation, I just have to plan out, okay, what's the sequence I'm going to do? And then I do it. Because, and I know my material cold, so even if somebody stops me, in fact, I usually say, you know, ask me questions in the middle, I'm fine, you know, you won't throw me off my game because I know what I'm doing, this is going to be a piece of cake. On this one, I mean, it was probably, you know, 75 hours of preparation to get this thing done, you know, just over and over and over again, trying to, because I had to learn it first, because I didn't know how to do what I was going to present.
Right. And I think that's really one of the real things that blind computer users struggle with, honestly, is that there is a big learning curve, even as great as the technology is. And I'm a huge Apple fanboy and am all about the fabulous job Apple has done making their products accessible. But even so, if you're going to operate one of these devices that were designed to be operated visually, a touch screen or a Mac, which was really designed to be operated largely with a mouse, with a graphical user interface, there is a lot to learn to make that all work reasonably seamlessly, even to do the basic things like send out a text message inviting someone to dinner. So I guess really, you know, you kind of demonstrated, even before you got up there, a little bit about what it takes to make this technology work for a blind person.
And one of the big surprising things to me, I'm a real visionary in my field, I tell you. I said a couple of years ago that the iPhone could never be accessible because it's a touch phone.
So did I, yeah.
I heard you say that on one of your shows and I was laughing. I also said no one ever needed a color screen. Let's see. I also said that you would never need a screen bigger than the Mac 512K. So, right. Like I said, a visionary, pretty much.
Right, right.
But the most interesting thing I learned in using the iPhone was so I'm a touch typist. I type about 60 words a minute. Been typing since I was 12 when I taught myself to type from a typewriter book. And
wow, you got done with the Braille and went right to typing, huh?
Yeah, I had they had to have something new to learn.
Okay,
and so. What I was fascinated by, though, was I thought that my brain knew where the letters were on the keyboard.
Uh-huh.
But it turns out my fingers know where the letters are.
Muscle memory.
My ring finger on my right hand is the one in charge of knowing where L and O are.
All right, absolutely.
My thumbs had no idea where L and O were.
Yep.
I would sit there just wandering all over the keyboard. She's yelling out all these letters, and I could not for the life of me figure out where – I had no idea. So over time – my thumbs learned where the keys were. And I thought that was really, really interesting in just how the brain works, that even though I've been typing with my thumbs on an iPhone for, 4 years, I didn't know where they were.
Yeah, I'm pretty fascinated by that. And it's got to be definitely a visual issue, I'm guessing, because I, like you, well, I started touch typing when I was in third grade because it was the only way I had to turn my assignments in. I could type them. Of course, I couldn't read them. But the only way I had to get them to my teachers who needed them in a printed format was to type them on a typewriter. So I had to learn to type.
Oh, interesting.
And that was an interesting thing. If the doorbell rang or the phone rang, you forgot where you were, you rip the page out and start the work over because you have no other way of doing it. But anyway, I did not have your experience so much with my thumbs on the iPhone because for me, it's very clear in my mind about where the O is positioned, same relation to the L. And I guess it's because I learned to do it in a non-visual way and, of course, learned to use the iPhone in a non-visual way. And I'm assuming you're like my wife. You typically would just, you know, type really fast on the iPhone by looking at the screen.
No, I wish I could remember who coined this phrase, but one of my blind friends, when I was complaining about having a problem with exactly like what you're talking about, he called me photon impaired.
Oh.
No, I'm sorry, photon dependent.
Oh, okay.
And that was actually such a perfect description because that was an impediment to me because I was used to seeing it. And so I needed to see it in order to do it.
Of course. Yeah.
And I thought that was a great line.
That is. I've never heard that before. That makes perfect sense, though. Okay, so you practiced and you got up there and you got ready to turn on the iPhone with your blindfold on, and what happened?
It was perfect.
Ooh, how nice.
It worked really, really well. So I got one of the things I needed to learn in order to succeed at this was how to recover if something unexpected happened. So yes. A lot of times, you know, if it worked flawlessly every time and then I got up there and it failed, that would have been a problem. But it worked just great. I was able to create the message. I was able to write to her. I was able to type the message out. And I spent a lot of time explaining to the audience what they would be hearing because they weren't able to see what I was seeing because just the logistics of the iPhone, I wasn't able to display that. So I explained to them that you touch a letter and when you lift, a different lady tells you that you typed it and that sort of thing. So
the audience really had to sort of get in an auditory mode as well.
Yeah, I suggested to them that they close their eyes.
Okay.
I said, why don't you just close your eyes and listen along and picture where things are on the iPhone yourself? And that kind of helps you think, okay, well, where is the compose button? Well, you need to know it's in the upper right or it's going to take you a lot longer to find it if you don't know where it is.
Right.
So I walked them through that. And I was able to hit send, and that worked great. And then I unplugged the audio from the iPhone with the blindfold still on, and I switched over to the Mac. And I have to tell you, I think the Mac is about 758 times harder than the iPhone to use.
You think it's a lot more complicated?
Yeah. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I think it certainly seems to be true for most people. Anything can be complicated when you're standing in front of an audience blindfolded. And, you know, certainly it's much harder at that moment. But I suppose the Mac is more, there's more to learn. I suppose it's more difficult to use. Although you would think in some ways, you know, intuitively, maybe the opposite would be true. That flat touchscreen ought to be really tough to use, but it's not.
Well, I think there's so little variability because you've got a small screen, and this gets back to one of my favorite episodes you did where you guys compared. I think the episode was called "Does Size Matter?"
Yeah,
where you compared the iPhone to the iPad, and I always figured the iPad would be four times as hard because it's four times the size or whatever it is because you've just got too much real estate to wander around and get lost. But it was fascinating that the way applications are designed kept that from being harder. But on the Mac, I am so used to using the mouse. There's just hundreds of commands to learn to move around, to navigate, to know that if she says button, it's VO space. But if it's a link, it's something different. You know, you need to interact. Okay, Control Option Shift Down Arrow. I'm going to need to interact with that. You know, having to bounce back and forth and listen to what she says before you choose which keystroke you use. That was amazing.
Yeah, you know, and where I really notice how different using the Mac is visually versus as a blind person is when I'm trying to tell my wife, who is sighted, how to do something on her Mac. And of course, she wants to do it with the mouse, and I'm wanting to tell her a keyboard shortcut. And, you know, we have, you know, quite a few discussions sometimes about why is this so frustrating? Because we have to approach the same task very differently. It's really different if you're listening to an interface versus if you're using it visually. There's just no question about that.
Well, and there is an entirely different way that the interaction takes place. So when I look at a website with my eyes, I can go directly to the thing I want to go to and click on it or type in a field and that sort of thing. But with VoiceOver, this concept of having to interact with it, that concept doesn't really exist. I mean, okay, let's say clicking is interacting, but the levels up and down that you have to go to, that threw me for a loop. I can't remember whether it was Buddy or who it was who helped me with that, but the idea that, for example, I went into iCal, and when I first go into iCal to create an event, it says scroll area.
Right.
Well, it's not telling me much about that, but okay, so I do Control Option Shift Down Arrow to interact with that. I was like, okay, now I understand it. But then I would get to something else I needed to interact with, and I had to go down another level, Control
right.
Option Shift Down Arrow again,
right.
And then having to Control Option Shift Up Arrow to get back up a level. That whole concept of up and down these levels just doesn't exist for the sightlings.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the areas that have been criticized about the way VoiceOver works in the Apple environment. Some people have said that it's more complicated in a lot of ways than it needs to be. And maybe it is, maybe it isn't. I think those of us who use it every day, you know, get so used to it that it just becomes second nature. But for you, trying to walk into it and make this work in a over a few month period to get ready for this presentation, I can only imagine would be terribly frustrating and confusing.
Well, yeah, and I didn't even know what question to ask. You know, I started, one of my visions was that I was going to send an email, and oh my God, mail is completely beyond me. Even when I'm looking and doing it, I can maybe once in a while accidentally get it right, but it's certainly not a smooth process.
Oh, I love Apple Mail with VoiceOver. It's one of my favorite things. So, you know.
So I saw a video that said how to do it the easy way, and I want to go watch that because the way I'm doing it is not easy. I mean, I'm going up and down and up and down. Why do they have to tell me about vertical splitters? I don't need to know there's a vertical splitter there. Why does it have to tell me that?
Right. Well, you know, that's the whole point, really, or what you're saying is exactly right. It's easy if you know the easy way to do it. It's really hard if you only know or don't know how to do it. It seems almost impossible.
I want to learn more, Robert. I don't want to stop here. But I need a forcing function to make me learn more because I want to know what's the easier way because I'm intrigued. It's like I've just had the taste of how this works and I want to know how to do it easier. It's fascinating.
Well, maybe we can figure out some ways to work on that.
Give me a weekly lesson or something.
Yeah, to learn. We can certainly come up with some ways because that's what I run into with people I meet who are blind who are wanting to learn the Mac. You know, it's not so easy. Even if you're coming from a Windows environment, to figure out the efficient way to do a lot of these things, if someone doesn't show you or you can't find good documentation or reading materials, there are a few more resources coming along. Other than typically, there's just been mainly podcasts talking about it, but there are. I know there's someone up at Handy Tech North America in Minnesota has a document that's designed to take people step by step through learning to use the Mac with VoiceOver. And so
I didn't find a lot. I tried to go out onto YouTube to look for videos and I found a couple of things, but they weren't very good in general. And
right.
I found Apple's VoiceOver manual, which would use terminology that I didn't know.
Yeah.
So that didn't really help very much. So I would get stuck and have to ask all you guys for help each time.
Well, I think that's one thing that we really need to improve on in 2012 is some much better documentation on
maybe even a wiki where you could gather together, you know, everybody contribute. What have you got that could help do this? It was some central repository where everybody posts, you know, lessons that they've created or whatever, and, you know, something like that.
It's a really good idea, and, you know, it needs to be done because the Mac is getting more and more popular. But let's don't get too far away from the presentation here. You put down the iPhone, you plugged in the Mac, and what happened?
Well, it started out real good. So the thing I was most terrified of was actually using Safari because I'd run into a lot of problems where I'd get stuck and I couldn't figure out how to get out and I kept ripping the blindfold off when I was practicing. So again, back to my plot was to invite Katie to dinner, go over with the iPhone, then go to the Mac, navigate to Yelp, find an Italian restaurant in San Francisco, copy the address, go into iCal, paste in the address, and invite her to that meeting invite.
Well, in all honesty, you really picked a pretty ambitious series of things to do, I think.
Oh, good. Well, what I wanted to do was try to hit a lot of different kinds of things.
Exactly.
So, like buttons versus interact with Element. You know, those are two very different things. And being able to pay attention to listening to that of which one you were on to know what keystroke you were supposed to do. One of the biggest things that threw me for a loop was how to copy text.
Right.
And I don't know whether it's something weird about Yelp, but being able to copy the address of the restaurant was very difficult. And one of the guys, and again, I should have kept notes on who told me what, but one of the guys said, well, use the, what is it, Control Option Shift C allows you to copy the last thing she said out loud.
Uh-huh.
And once I found that was awesome because she just said it, right? As long as I was quick about it. Because I kept verbosity up fairly high. In fact, I think on the highest level because I was trying to learn it. And so she would start yapping about something else. So you had to be snappy.
Right. There are a lot of people struggle with copying text, and I think that probably could be improved. But so you started out then first by bringing up Safari.
Yeah. So I used Spotlight to launch Safari, And then I used Command L to get to the URL bar, which as a site link is what I use. And I typed in Yelp.com. And one of the problems I'd had was that if I'd already been there once before and I quit Safari and went back in, frequently it started like in the middle of the page somewhere. And I couldn't figure out how to get to the search window again. So one of the tricks I learned in watching one of the videos was how to get to the menus. So Control Option M to get to the menus. And I figured out I could navigate over to the Safari menu and go down to private browsing, which would erase whatever I had just done in the browser, do that, then quit Safari and go back in. So that was that was one of my recovery methods, but it was repeatable. You know, no matter what went wrong, I knew I could get myself back to a known condition, which I think is a big trick to it.
You are nothing if not creative to come up with a solution like that. Oh, okay. So what happened?
So I went to Yelp.com, and I one of the other things that I thought was fascinating was the concept of QuickNav. And I describe QuickNav as a double-edged sword. If you forget and leave QuickNav on, you can really screw yourself up. So you got to
heap
turn
of
it
trouble.
Off. You don't need it. Yeah, and that was one of the things that was botching things up was I had QuickNav on, and somebody said, "Oh, cripes, you got to turn QuickNav off." I said, "Well, wait a minute, you guys just told me to turn it on."
Yeah.
So I'm much more fond of QuickNav than the rotor. The rotor still sort of baffles me. So, but make sure I get back to that because I have a really interesting thing to say about that. Okay. So I had to turn QuickNav off. I could then do my search, and I also talked in this pitch about the variability of response. So if you type your search term in Yelp, she doesn't tell you what you wrote. But when you go to the field where you type in the city, she does.
Oh.
And so one of the things I asked the guys was, how do I get her to say what I just did? And they said, well, just, you know, control option, right arrow, back arrow, and she'll say when you go backwards, she'll tell you what you just did. So I made a point of that, you know, you don't know what the website's going to do, how it's going to react. Even one that Yelp is actually pretty good, has lots of headings in it.
Mm-hmm.
When I was having trouble with Yelp the first time, when I couldn't figure out where I was on the page, my son said, well, you know, why don't you just try like, I don't know, Urban Spoon. I suggest all of you go to Urban Spoon who are blind and see how lovely it is.
Oh, sounds like we're going to love it.
Oh, it's just, oh, it's lovely. It's about 700 keystrokes to get to where you can find a restaurant in San Francisco. They have one heading on each page, and they put about 75 links before you can get to the content.
You would starve to death before you got to the restaurant.
Yeah. So I'm using them as the humiliating thing. And I'm going to write to them about it and describe how I discovered how bad this was and suggest, you know, if, for Pete's sake, could you use a heading once in a while?
Absolutely.
Which, by the way, I didn't know about until you guys told me. You know, I used bold for each of the sections on my website, and somebody said, oh, for the love of God, would you please put a heading in once in a while? And I didn't know that it made a difference.
Well, headings are really good ways to jump around a web page with voiceover.
Yeah, but we didn't know. And so that's one of the things I like to tell people, and everybody I tell goes, well, that's easy. I could do that. You know, but we just don't know. You know, it's not a thing we would know.
Well, that's a lot of the problem with accessibility or lack of accessibility, I think, really honestly, is that people don't know. And once I love so many of the Apple developers and website developers, if you just let them know, they're happy to find out and they're willing to fix it.
Yeah. I'm also finding it interesting. If people follow the APIs, it appears that things work automatically. I got listed by a tool called Mac Hash. It's an iPhone app, and it's also a website. And when the guy put it in, I thought, hey, I can test to see if it's accessible now because I know how.
Yeah.
And just about everything is accessible and works beautifully. And I wrote to him, and I said, well, how hard was it to do that? And he said, it's accessible?
Yeah, see,
love that answer.
Apple's done a great job with their API. If people don't decide, you know, I can do it better by adding this custom widget or whatever, which then breaks voiceover. But if people would stick to the Apple guidelines, it would be fabulous. But yeah I got that app after listening to you talk about it on your podcast, and I like it a lot. It's a good way to keep up with the Mac news.
Exactly. And one of the things he said was, it's really cool that those tools are there for me because I didn't have to put any effort in and I made it accessible automatically. How great is that? So he liked that it worked so well. So that was kind of cool. So let's get back to when disaster struck.
Oh, no. I was hoping there wouldn't be such an item, but here we go.
Yeah, me too. Me too, as it turns out. So one of the main things you learn when you're like 5 years old is never, ever, 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 ever change anything at the last minute before you're doing a presentation, right? Everybody knows that.
But it's rare that we stick to that, but go ahead.
So I was in the speaker's lounge before the show and before the event, and I was doing one more practice run through, and I thought, you know what? Why am I drilling down into this folder to get my keynote presentation? I just should just toss it on the desktop. Well, that was the worst thing I could possibly have done. Somehow, when I got done with Safari, and now I wanted to switch over to iCal, I think I quit Safari. In fact, I'm going to go back and listen to the video and try to figure out exactly why this went so horribly wrong.
Yeah, it'd be fun to get to the bottom of that.
Yeah, because I haven't been able to replicate it on my own. What happened was somehow I got stuck on that document on my desktop. It was like I had my foot nailed to the floor and I was just walking in circles.
Oh, no.
I couldn't get off of it. So somehow it was doing, it was either doing Quick Look or Spotlight, I'm not sure which, inside the document. And so I would try to, you know, Command Tab to get back to just a Finder where I could then do Spotlight, but it wouldn't do Spotlight. And she wasn't telling me anything. She stopped talking.
Oh, no.
So I just kept going, guys, I don't know what's happening. And so the audience started participating a lot, trying to help me figure out what it was doing. And they'd say, well, you're inside Keynote. And I said, well, I never launched Keynote. And they said, well, you're in Quick Look or you're in Spotlight in Keynote. And I said, well, I don't want to be in that. And I thought, all right, I'll just open a Finder window so it'll cover it up somehow, and that'll fix things. So I opened a Finder window. I said, Command N for new Finder window. And now it started doing Quick Look inside the Finder. So I started opening things up on screen, and my husband was getting a little worried I was going to open a tax return or something.
Yeah, right.
Or something worse.
Yeah.
And the audience kept trying to help me, and I ended up having to take the blindfold off. And I was so disappointed because I just really thought, you know, no matter what, I could recover. And so I was kind of depressed, and throughout the thing, you can hear me saying, not what I was looking for here, guys. And so I was really disappointed, but the audience reaction after the fact was really gratifying. They told me that it was a much better illustration of how hard it is for them than it would have been had I flawlessly executed my objective.
Well, that's true. I can certainly see that side of it. That is, did point that out for sure, but I can also see your disappointment because you really had practiced hard and you're like me, you like things to go as planned, and you were hoping for big success there, and that is disappointing. And I bet you somehow did get stuck in the Quick Look panel, and it sometimes can be a bit hard to get out of that once you get into it. But so when you took the blindfold off, were you able to figure it out?
Well, I think I actually turned VoiceOver off, launched iCal, and then put the blindfold back on, because by this time I'd lost like 5 minutes. And uh-huh. Believe it or not, you know, writing a text message, finding a restaurant, and sending an iCal message was about 45 minutes worth of work at my skill level. One of the things, I did a dry run before I did the presentation. I did a dry run with some friends of mine. And one of the things I like to show them was how many commands are available. If you hit, Control Option HH shows you all of the command, keystroke commands. And there's what? 78,000 commands.
Yeah, there are a lot of them. That's for sure.
So he suggested that I do an eye chart, take screenshots of a bunch of those and paste them onto one of my slides. And that was really, really effective. There was an audible gasp in the room. I only showed, I think, 15 screens, and there's, like I said, there's hundreds, I think, in there.
Yeah.
So that was pretty effective. So one of the things I was trying to do was show them all these keystrokes. But I'm curious, which objective you would have rather I meet? My objective going in was to show people how cool it is and how you can do everything blind. What I ended up demonstrating was how hard it is. Which would you rather I had successfully done?
Well, I think that the way that it turned out is really fairly realistic in the sense that, you know, if you had practiced for several more months, chances are, I suspect, it would have been easier to demonstrate exactly what you wanted to demonstrate. But for someone who has just started this process only a few months ago, really kind of learning this from scratch, I think you did remarkably well. And people need, that's the hard thing I think for people to realize, is that if you're blind and you want to learn to use Windows or the Mac, you better count on putting quite a bit of time into it. And so I think the objective, you know, of showing the reality of what it's like for someone who's been working with it, the amount of time that you have in that way, seems to me to be pretty right on, pretty realistic. Okay. It's really kind of, I guess, what I would expect. And that's been one of the hardest things for me, is that I am such a technology enthusiast. I love the technology, but I'm a guy who will spend whatever time it takes to master that skill. And most people are just not as, most people have a life, I guess. Most people have other things to do, you know, whereas I'll spend all weekend if that's what it takes to get this or that thing working, you know, in a way that I can use it with VoiceOver. But most people don't love it.
It's a tool to them, not the end objective.
It's a tool to them. Yes, it's a tool to them. And when I used to train people, when I was finishing my PhD in psychology, one of the things I did was run a little computer lab training blind people in the community to use, at that time, the Apple IIe, Apple II technology. And I found that most people, you know, honestly, were tired of it or would give up on it before they really mastered it. And that was terribly frustrating to me, but I think it speaks to what you experienced in this presentation, is that, you know, things can go wrong if you've had, like I have, you know, 30 years of practice, things can go wrong and still get messed up in a presentation, no question about it. But the more you do it, the more automatic it gets, and the more times you've run into that little thing where, oh yeah, I remember that time I got, you know, stuck in Preview or whatever it was, and I now know how to get out of it. But I think it turned out exactly the way that
it should.
Yeah, I think, as we say in psychology, you just have to trust that process, and that's what you did. So
you bring up another question, though. In my case, I had 12 people at my I don't want to say beck and call, but at my fingertips that I could ask questions of, that I knew within a couple hours I'd get an answer. How does somebody who doesn't have that access get that help? I mean, and a few people asked me that. They said, well, if I, you know, my brother's blind, how would he learn this? How did you learn it? You know, how did that work? And he said, I didn't know the answer. I said, I guess I would call the Braille Institute.
Well, I think the answer is not a very clear one or a very good one. Certainly, you know, each state has some sort of commission for the blind, or sometimes they call them division of blind services. And every state, as far as I know, has some sort of training facilities within that agency. But the gotcha is, it, heaven only knows whether you're going to happen to live in a state where anyone there knows anything about the Mac. Okay. They know about Windows. They know about certain screen readers for Windows. But even the less popular screen readers, they may not know. They know about the ones that they've always purchased through state rehab money for people. And it's only been in recent years that the Mac has even, you know, started to be on their radar. So it's a little bit like being in a wilderness. You know, it's you need to network with other people who are blind, who are doing it. You need to listen to all the podcasts where things are being demonstrated and talked about. There are, like I said, a few training materials out there that you can purchase now off the internet, but it's not a very easy thing to get going on, and that saddens me. And I'd like to be one of the people who try to work to do something serious about that. But it's a very good question.
I'm interested in helping with that, Robert, to try to figure out how to create a more formalized network. I mean, you know, if you need to know how to do something on the Mac, you go to the Mac discussion forums, and there they are, and you've got a topic area. I'm trying to learn Final Cut Pro. Here's what I learned.
Right.
It would seem to me that we ought to be able to get the people who are willing to help each other, which appears to be most, if not all, that I've ever met are willing to help in some way,
right,
to contribute information. And, you know, hey, I did a little, you know, I did a show on this particular topic. Get it posted where there's some sort of centralized way, you know, done in a social way to figure this out, where people could post questions. And
there is a site that's really an up and coming good resource called appleviz.com, appleviz.com, and they publish a lot of information on accessible apps, and they're starting to do podcasts now on how to use this or that, both on the Mac and on iOS devices. And so appleviz.com seems to be something that's coming along, and there may be, you know, some real emphasis there on pulling information together. But a lot more needs to be done in that area. And honestly, I think a lot of us have been so busy learning ourselves, and probably a lot of us are more of the people who have accomplished this are probably a bit more introverted, more than likely, a bit more, you know, we're the ham radio guys who are perfectly fine sitting in our little podcasting studio working on this by ourselves, and maybe don't reach out quite as much as we should. Although I agree with you that when you do ask for help, you know, people are very forthcoming, at least in my experience, with offering it. But the other part of it is everybody has different ways of going about things. Because we haven't learned in a united way, we've all developed our own strategies. And, you know, what works great for me in Apple Mail, somebody will try it and say, that's too cumbersome for me, or that doesn't get me the information exactly the way that I want it. So, you know, it's a complex problem that we don't have good answers for at this point.
Yeah, I'm looking at applevis.com, and it does look like it's got some interesting stuff. Maybe that's a place to go start helping. There's user groups. I wonder what else they've got. So.
Yeah.
I had a couple other questions for you. People have asked me, how difficult is VoiceOver compared to JAWS? Is it? And what I suggested the answer was, it's sort of like saying, what's harder, Italian or Portuguese? They're both Romance languages, and they share a lot of the same kind of concepts, but they diverge.
Yeah, I couldn't tell you specifically about JAWS. I don't use it and never have. Oh, okay. I use other Windows screen readers, and I would say that they are all reasonably at a comparable level of difficulty. They all require one to learn a lot of commands to be able to access the information that's on the screen. They're very different. The Windows screen readers don't do the interacting thing the way that VoiceOver does. But on the other hand, VoiceOver, if you know how to use it pretty well, gives you quite a bit more of a realistic realistic idea, I think, of what's actually on the screen. So there are always trade-offs, but I don't think VoiceOver, for me at least, is no more difficult than the other screen readers. But it is different. And what's intriguing to me is I probably know, three screen readers really well, and multiple other devices really well, and it's a lot to keep in one's head. You know,
I had a roommate in college who was a linguistics major, and she took Italian from 8 to 9, Spanish from 9 to 10, 10 to 11 was Italian. By noon, she couldn't speak any of them.
Yeah, she would know what I'm talking about here. You said a couple questions. Did you have another question?
Yeah, the other one they asked, or they assumed, and I always like it when we assume things when we have no knowledge in a subject, but
they all do it.
They assume that because you can't see, you somehow have superhuman memory and so are able to remember all of these commands simply because you have to, but your brain isn't cluttered with all that visual information. And that seemed naive to me, but maybe it's true.
Well, you know, there used to be a lot of myths about people's senses compensating if they lose one of their senses. And we used to laugh about that. We used to really sort of say, that's just a myth. That's, you know, that's what happens with the superheroes, with Daredevil. But the reality of it is, in recent years, there have been quite a few studies that have shown that the brain is flexible enough and pliable enough that when it somehow realizes that the visual cortex isn't being used for vision, it will actually transfer some of that processing power, if you will, into doing things with some of the other senses.
Okay.
And so, you know,
okay, there could be some truth behind it.
There could be some truth behind it. There really
what
could.
What if you're forgetful and blind, though? I mean, some people by nature are forgetful.
Oh, absolutely.
That must be.
I know plenty of forgetful blind people. You know, they're just because you're blind doesn't mean you have the market on having a good memory. And it's just like anything else. You have to work with what you got. You know, you have to maybe take more notes or compensate in some way. But those are great questions, though. And the thing that I love about what you're doing is you're getting people to even think about it and talk about it and ask questions about it. And that's exactly where we have to start.
What I like about doing it this way is it's not like, oh, we need to help those poor blind people. It's like, hey, this is fascinating. This is interesting. How does this work? How can I make it work better? I also pitched this. I did an accessibility speech at Blog World last year, and my purpose in it was to put right out in front of them, my opening chart was, at the time anyway, there were as many visually impaired and hearing impaired people in the world as are on Facebook.
Wow.
Now, Facebook's bigger now.
Yeah.
The number was 700 million, and Facebook's now to 850 million. But the point I made to the people in the room was, you're all blogging and podcasting and doing everything. How do I grow my audience? If you're ignoring 700 million people, you're doing it wrong, right?
Good point.
There's some easy picking. So trying to motivate people from what's in it for them, not what's in it for you, but what's in it for them. So one of the charts I put in Blindfolded was that there's 1.3 million legally blind people in the U.S. alone. That's a much smaller number than the visually impaired, but still, with a 70% unemployment rate, if these tools can be developed better and better and better, I'm guessing if you could use a computer, you're more likely to be employed.
Absolutely.
Kind of a jump, but you know, I think so, right?
No, I think you're absolutely right. You've got to be able to use the technology to be able to become employed. I personally am advocating more and more these days that I think people really need, if they're capable of it physically, they really need to also learn to, at least to make some use of Braille to be employed, mm-hmm. because you just flat need a written language. You need a way to keep notes. And, you know, for years I was really all about processing as much information as fast as I possibly could. And I'm a really fast Braille reader, but I can listen to speech synthesis much faster than I can read Braille. I think anybody can. So I was all about speed. But in my old age, I've begun to slow down and realize that it's not all about speed. If I really want to fully invest myself in that novel or that New York Times article, I'm better off reading it in Braille and actually seeing those words and seeing the punctuation and paying attention.
I remember you talking about that on the show, and I thought that was really, really interesting that you would force yourself up until you got tired and then you would listen.
Yeah, that happens quite a bit. And I'm getting we've got more access to Braille materials these days with electronic publishing being the way it is. We can now read EPUB in Braille and PDFs and a lot, you know, there's a lot of access to materials. And so I'm hoping that we see a big renaissance in that area. The big problem though that we're facing is electronic Braille devices are really, really expensive. And so people can't afford them who need them. And the government isn't providing them so much because of the economy and all. So anyway, I hope we come to some solutions there in the next few years that make that whole process easier. But anyway,
I've had a burning question about Braille readers, and I know the purpose of the show is not for me to learn, but
well, sure.
The tech doctor is all about
learning is all in your head. Go for it.
Okay, there's one thing I completely don't understand. So a Braille display plugs into the USB port and looks like dominoes with a little chiclets with a little white dots going up and down, and I got that part. How do you move across the screen so that different things pop up on the Braille display? Are you using one hand on the trackpad and one hand on the Braille display, or how are you navigating?
Well, in most cases, you can actually control the screen movement from the Braille display itself. So when you press a button on the right side of the Braille display, it advances you across the screen the number of characters that your Braille display is capable of displaying. So you can pan left and right, if you will, and eventually up and down across the screen. So you can control it from a trackpad or from the voiceover keys on your keyboard, but you'd have to take your hands off the display
to do that. So it's actually on the Braille display to do that.
You're right. Okay. You actually can do most of the Braille displays. The current ones will let you control movement across the screen from the display itself.
So do they have voiceover keys and up, down, right, left arrows and to do those kind of commands?
Equivalent keys, yeah. Keys that will let you move up and down, left and right, and they all vary a little bit in how they go about that. And, you know, it depends on what you're doing on the screen. It's different if you're looking at a web page versus, you know, looking through a list of files. You might need to do things a little differently, but they're becoming more flexible and more capable. And so it's really the affordability thing. We've got to conquer that somehow. It's, you know, $6,000, $7,000, $10,000, $20,000 for a Braille display when you think about.
Are you serious?
Yeah, they're very, very expensive.
$6,000?
Well, $6,000 is
at the low end.
Is kind of at the low end. Although there are some cheaper ones coming out. I know one of my favorite companies called Hims has announced a new Braille display to be coming out for. Which has the capability of displaying 40 characters at a time, or 40 cells, as we call it, and it's going to be right at $3,000, 29 something. So
that's still ridiculous,
you know. But these devices are low incidence. They don't sell very many of them. There's a lot of research and development. The Braille displays themselves have to be pretty much assembled by hand, because every one of those dots has to work perfectly, or you're displaying the wrong thing. And so, you know, there are a lot of reasons why they cost as much as they do, but we got to do something about it.
Yeah.
It's just, you shouldn't have to pay way more for your Braille display than you pay for your MacBook Air. You know, it just doesn't make sense, but it is the way it is right now. Anyway, is there anything else that you want to tell us about your presentation experience, or have we kind of covered what you wanted to say about it?
I think we've covered everything. Overall, I think it was one of the most fascinating things I've done lately, and I was just I really, really enjoyed it. And I'm going to keep giving a shout out to all the people who helped me with this: Buddy Brannon, Slough, Daryl Shander, Dan Eckmeyer, Donald Breda, Keith Watson, Joshua Leah, Kevin Chow, Scott Howell, James Austin, Bill Holden, and Dr. Robert Carter, and a woman named Laura Schindler, who is not blind, but she teaches blind children, and she was quite a bit of help to me in talking about different things that I could do. So shout out to all 13 of you and all the help that you guys gave me over the last couple months.
Well, thanks. And you had some great help with that. And so, yeah, those are some people who really know a lot about this whole area. So keep in touch with us on it, and let's keep looking at ways to network and ways to find people what they need when they're struggling with trying to do this or that task on the Mac with VoiceOver.
Oh, yeah. And one other thing, this is not a one-shot deal. I'm going to do it again at the Mac Computer Expo in October. I met the woman who runs it, and I'm going to connect it up with her. And she asked me if I would do it at the Mac Computer Expo. And I'm also going to do it on the Mac Mania cruise in October in Australia.
Excellent.
So this is not a one-shot deal. And I'm presenting it inside my company, so I'm trying to get more chances to use what I learned.
Well, I so appreciate what you're doing with that, Allison. You're taking it all the way around the world. Good for you. That's a fabulous thing. I'm really excited about it. And I thank you for coming on and sharing it with us today. And I suspect our listeners are going to be quite interested and intrigued by this. And do you have any contact information you'd like to leave people with?
Oh, you betcha. So my website is podfeet.com. The podcast is called the NoCillaCast Mac Podcast in iTunes. And I'm on Twitter at Podfeet. I'm on Google Plus. I do a lot of stuff over there. I occasionally remember to go to Facebook under my own name, under Allison Sheridan. But I also, if you want to email me directly, my email is on my website, but it's Allison@podfeet.com. That's Allison with two L's, by the way.
Perfect. And if you want to comment about what you've heard today to me, feel free to email me at techdoctor123@gmail.com, and we'll be happy to get back with you and discuss this topic further. And again, Allison, thank you so much for coming on, and I look forward to the next time.
Well, thanks for not telling him that I begged you to let me be on the show.
We'll never tell him that. So long, everybody.